What's going on today in football? The attempts to create a European Super League. The way in which the elite clubs are coming together, they're trying to create an organisation that's based purely on commercial viability and purely on its ability to generate more money for those elite clubs. That's actually exactly why the Football League was formed.
Football, depending on where you are in the world, can mean very different things. In the US, football is a physical game played with an oval ball, aiming to cross the opponent's goal line or kick it through the posts. Globally, football typically refers to what Americans call soccer, a game where teams of 11 use their feet to score by getting a spherical ball into the opponent's goal. This version of football reigns supreme as the world's most beloved sport, but have you ever wondered how we got here? How did we end up with different variations of the same game, and what does the future hold for football? To answer these questions and shed light on football's history, I've got in touch with a historian who literally wrote the book on this topic. So, what is the history of football?
Well, we could be here for the next several weeks talking about this. I think basically, wherever humans have gathered together and created a society and civilization, they've always played some games with a ball, and that's involved kicking a ball, throwing a ball, catching a ball, and propelling the ball by foot or by hand or however towards some kind of goal. And so if you like, football in its most generic sense has always existed, and it appeals to something deep, I think, in the human psyche about the pleasure of playing team sports, the emotional high you get of being involved in the team or supporting the team. I mean, that's the other unique thing, I think, about all the different types of football, that if you're a fan of a team, then you are as invested in the result of the match that your team is playing as the players on the pitcher, possibly even more so, really. So I think that's always been part of that's always been part of human society. The modern football codes all derive from Britain in the middle of the 19th century, when a lot of the old style football, which was based around agricultural society, so when crops have been sown in the fields, there would be festivals and football would be played. When harvests were being made, festivals would be held and football would be played. And similarly on religious holidays, football games and various types of play. None of them had any fixed rules. None of them kind of extended beyond their own locality. So you couldn't have a game between two towns, because if they didn't have their own games of football, they had their own rules and they weren't really interchangeable. And it's only really in the middle of the 19th century, and football is taken up by the elite English private schools, that common rules start to be drawn up. And really that's what's going on in the 1860s and 1870s when the Football Association was formed, and then later in 1863, and then later in 1871, the Rugby Football Union is also formed as this kind of rival. And it's interesting to note, again, that they both have football in the title, that for much of the 19th century, people thought that there was a game called football, but there were different ways to play it, and that rugby rules are just a different version of football, and association rules, what became known as soccer, were just another version of football. So it's only really in the middle of the 19th century that you get the idea that we want to have a set of rules that everybody can play. So that we can have matches between different villages, different towns, even different streets, and primarily initially between different clubs. And that was the idea behind the formation of the Football Association, that, as they said, we want to have one winter sport, football playing the rest of Britain in the winter. We want to have one set of rules for our one winter sport. Just like cricket is the summer sport and that has one set of rules, football should also have one set of rules that everybody can play by. But of course, these things aren't that simple. And the FA had 7 meetings to try and decide a common set of rules, which they kept changing their minds. And then even when they had decided on a common set of rules, a number of the clubs decided they didn't like them, and eventually formed the Rugby Football Union in 1871, which is how the divide between rugby and football really, really started to develop.
A game that roughly resembles modern association football existed as far back as the 2nd and 3rd centuries in China. as well as the Greeks, Romans, Native Americans, and indigenous people of the Australian continent all having some type of ball game in their culture. However, modern football, which evolved out of medieval football, the localized version we'll come to hear about in a minute, wasn't codified until 1848. So, how did football go from being a marginal activity that, as Tony will help explain, had no fixed rules to becoming a codified dominant winter sport?
Well, I mean, that's a great question because, you know, for almost centuries in Britain and probably everywhere else around the world, football was seen as a kind of a sport of the masses, of the common people, if you like. And it's only really in that very short period in the 19th century when Britain is becoming, you know, the dominant industrial and imperial power around the world, and public schools, which, I mean, for listeners, they're not actually open to the public. It's one of the great anomalies of the English language, that private English private schools are called public schools. So these private schools were there to train the leaders of industry and the empire. And one of the ways in which they felt was important to educate those young men was through sport, because they believed that sport would educate them in the moral values of the British upper classes. And so the idea of fair play, teamwork, and amateurism all came from that type of what was called muscular Christian ideology, which is really like a form of British nationalism. And sport became very important. Cricket also was very important to that ideology as well, which is how cricket spread around the British Empire. And so the schools are important because they, in a sense, they legitimised football so that it was no longer seen as a common activity which, the well-to-do young men wouldn't get involved in. It was now seen as a form of moral education that was more than a game. It was about educating young men in morality and in the values of the British Empire. And that's how it managed to get such a big foothold in the 1860s and 70s, when it was primarily at that point a game still for young men from the upper classes. And it wasn't until the later 1870s when football suddenly begins to take off and become this massive, huge popular sport amongst everybody.
Like me, most of you listening to this will have an understanding of football from the last few decades, where football has predominantly been perceived as a sport of the working class, deeply woven into the fabric of local communities and acting as a unifying symbol for the masses. However, you might join me in being surprised to learn that its roots are steeped in the realm of the upper class and prestigious private schools. So how did this game shift from being the pastime of the upper class to becoming the heartbeat of the working class?
Essentially, I think what happened was that, well, there were two things going on. In British society in general, in the last third of the 19th century, from the mid-1870s, standards of living amongst working class people started to grow. They had more leisure time. The number of hours they had to go to work was reduced. Wages went up. And things like literacy increased as well. So, you know, more people could read newspapers and follow what was going on in the world. So there was that, if you like, those objective factors that meant the working class had a bit more money, had more leisure time, and was more educated. The other thing that went on within the sport itself is that in the 18, I guess the most important thing which inspired a lot of these changes was in 1871, the Football Association began the FA Cup tournament for a cup to be played by. Initially, it was only a handful of clubs that played for it, and they were usually they came from the elite section of the British society. But, you know, everybody's aware today that cup competitions are fantastically interesting and exciting, and they capture people's imagination. And so, slowly over the 1870s and the 1880s, the FA Cup began to become more and more popular. And the reasons are obvious, because, you know, my town could play your town, and the local rivalries could be, you know, the local rivalries that everybody had were now being played in a type of mini battlefield. And you also had other tensions. So you had, in England, there's a lot of rivalry between the North and the South. So you could have teams from the North playing teams from the South. And you also had class rivalries as well, because Britain at that time, in fact, it still is, but Britain even more so at that time, was very sort of class stratified. And, you know, the chances of someone who worked in a textile factory in Lancashire meeting someone who had been educated at, you know, an elite private school like Eton or Harrow was, you know, pretty much impossible. However, the FA Cup meant that, as did happen, teams from the north of England that were primarily composed of factory workers could end up being drawn against teams of the elite of British society. So, you know, and again, sort of class tensions, class rivalry, the opportunity to get one over those people who thought they were your betters was, you know, tremendously exciting. And a classic example of that is in the late 1870s when Darwin, a quite small textile town in Lancashire, played the Old Etonians in the FA Cup. And Darwin, which was, you know, primarily composed of players from who, you know, worked in a factory 6 days a week, drew with the Old Etonians twice. And that was kind of, in a sense, that match signified the appeal of the FA Cup, because for the first time in Britain, the, if you like, representatives of the two classes, the working class and the upper class, actually met on a football field, and the working classes almost beat them. And in fact, in the 1880s, that they'd beat them more and more. So it's really cup competitions that start to really increase the support for the game. And, you know, so the FA Cup was the national cup, but then also you got local cups springing up all over the place. So by the time you get to 1880, pretty much every town and city in Britain had its own local football cup competition. And that helped to popularise it, because, again, yeah, I'm sure everybody listening to this knows what it's like to go to a cup tie and experience that thrill of seeing your team in a do-or-die effort to make the next round of the cup against big rivals, or, you know, you can be a giant killer, or, you know, there's so many aspects that make this, you know, make cup ties not, you know, not just enjoyable, but immerse you in the passion and the emotion of the event. And that's how it, and I think that's really what provided the impetus for football to become this huge juggernaut by 1900.
As Tony's mentioned already, there are various disagreements that led to the different forms of football. But how did we end up with so many variations?
Well, I mean, one of the interesting things that's not really appreciated anymore is that initially rugby was the more popular game over football. And certainly, even in the 1880s, early 1880s, you can still find newspaper reports that say that, you know, rugby is still a more popular game. And that, we'll get into why that changed shortly. But that's one of the reasons why, if you look around the world, most of the sort of, if you like, national variations of American football, Australian rules football, rugby union football, rugby league football, they're played with an oval ball. Because rugby rules were really the first set of rules of football, in inverted commas, that were taken around the British Empire. And so in the, you know, what the white colonies, if you like, of the British Empire, like Australia, Canada, which also had its own type of football, America, which obviously broke away from the British Empire in the 18th century, but was still very closely, you know, culturally linked to Britain, they adopted rugby rules initially, and then they began to amend them to make what they felt was a better game. And because the Rugby Football Union wasn't formed until 1871, the game in Australia, Canada and America started to change the rules before there was a central governing body. So in a sense, they kind of got away from the mother country of Britain before Britain had a chance to impose a governing body on on those games. And so, you know, American football changed the rules very quickly because they felt that there was too much, you know, scrum in rugby was too messy. And so they had the line of scrimmage and the snap. And in Australia, they got rid of the offside rules, so you could just kick the ball down, and got rid of the crossbar and all things like this. So everybody had their own variants, which is initially how football, it's kind of going back to how football in its biggest sense was, that every locality in Britain had their own rules. And so most of the, as I said, the white colonies and the empire had their own rules as well. So that's how these games spread around the world, if you like, before football, in the sense that the oval ball games globalised, at least in the English-speaking world, before football even had a chance. But I think the decisive factor in changing that balance of forces was the fact that in 1885, football in England legalised professionalism. Up until that point, football had tried to be an amateur game and said people shouldn't receive wages for playing it, maybe expenses for travelling to away matches, but that was all. But obviously, as the game becomes more popular, there's a lot more riding. If you want to, you know, you want to win the FA Cup, or even if you want to win the local cup, for example, one of the biggest local ones is the Birmingham District FA Cup. If you wanted to win the Birmingham Cup, you needed a good team. And, you know, obviously, as these things go, you don't often get all the best players coming from one place, from one town or one region. And so they started to import players, particularly import players from Scotland, where there's a great tradition of playing football. And to import players, obviously, you need to give them jobs, you need to offer them wages. The Football Association tried to clamp down on that, but the top clubs in the north of England said, if you're not going to allow us to pay our players, then we're going to break away from our own organisation where we can play players. And eventually, compromise was found, and in 1885, the FA legalised professionalism. One of the things that happened, which goes back to this, the way the elites control the game, was that once professionalism was legalised, teams in the north of England and in the Midlands, which were predominantly made up of, you know, players from a working class background, started to dominate the FA Cup. And from 1885, not another team that was comprised mainly of private schoolboys or university-educated players ever appeared in the FA Cup final again. It was dominated by, you know, clubs like Blackburn Olympic originally, then Blackburn Rovers, Aston Villa, Preston North End. All these kind of famous teams, what are now famous teams, came to prominence in the 1880s after the legalisation of professionalism. Rugby's response to that was the response of rugby's leaders anyway, where they had the same problems. They had local competitions. Rugby's response was to say, this is terrible. We don't want our elite teams to be overshadowed by, you know, what they call, you know, teams of working men. And so they decided, instead of legalising professionalism, they would completely ban it and declared rugby to be an amateur sport. And that was just 18 months after the Football Association allowed professionalism. So within the space of 2 years, you had the two organisations were going separate ways. One was going to professionalism. The other was turning its back on professionalism. And you can see how that played out in that the SA Cup became incredibly successful. By 1901, 100,000 people were going to the FA Cup final. But rugby union didn't allow a national cup competition because it felt that would encourage professionalism. In football, in 1888, the Football League was formed, the first soccer league in the world, which was shortly expanded to have a second division, then after World War One, third and fourth division. Rugby, on the contrary, didn't allow leagues because it felt that that would also encourage professionalism. And so rugby had turned its back on really the modern way of playing sport, of cup competitions, league competitions, and turned its back on professionalism as well. So while football was gaining massively, because the Football League was even more popular than the FA Cup, because that, with a league system, you could get big crowds going to watch the best teams every week. Rugby clubs in the north of England felt that rugby was going in the wrong direction, and they campaigned for what they call broken time payments to players to compensate them for the time they took off work. The rugby union refused to allow this, and eventually in 1895, rugby split into two games, rugby league and rugby union. So, whilst football was gaining massive popularity, rugby was turning its back on the modern way of organising sport, and then it split into two. And so football became the undoubted, undisputed biggest sport in Britain. And then its popularity in Europe was such that in 1904, the football associations in the leading European countries formed FIFA, which soon linked up with the leading countries in South America. The British Football Associations, as usual, weren't very keen on international organisations, so they joined initially. But combined with the eclipse of rugby in Britain, the formation of FIFA allowed football to spread around the world in a way that no other sport could compete with. And so it's that crucial period from like 1880 to 1900 that really spelled the end of rugby's mass popularity, but the beginning of football's spiraling into becoming, you know, undoubtedly the most important game in the world.
Sport, as we've seen from perhaps more recent history, has a close relationship with politics. Similarly, Gaelic football and Irish nationalism are inextricably linked.
Yeah, no, that's really interesting because Ireland at this time was still occupied by the British, so it's part of Great Britain in inverted commas, and so many of the traditions of Britain were exported to Ireland, and in particular, again, because rugby was the most popular type of football initially, rugby went to Ireland in the same way as it did to the rest of Britain through the universities and the elite private schools. But obviously the big difference between England, Wales, Scotland and Ireland was that in Ireland there was a significant and powerful nationalist movement that wanted independence from Britain. And for many Irish nationalists, the fact that the Ireland was playing what they saw as British games, particularly rugby, soccer and athletics, and also cricket to some extent, was that this was an affront because, you know, the Irish had their own culture and their own, historically they played football, football for a long time, and they also had their own game of hurling, which was had a very long history in Ireland. And so in the 1880s there was tremendous revival of the Gaelic language, of Gaelic cultural traditions, and many Irish nationalists felt that the time was right to revive Irish sporting traditions as well. And so many of the people who've been British in the British style public school system or in universities influenced by Britain kind of rebelled against the idea of British sport and decided that they would play what they call Gaelic football. There was a slight problem in that there was, although said various games of football had been played across Ireland for time immemorial, just like anywhere else, there was no agreed set of rules as to how football should be played in Ireland. Each area had its own given set. And so a set of rules had to be basically invented by the Gaelic Athletic Association, which had been formed in 1884, which initially were based on rugby, but then they moved away quite quickly. They got rid of the oval ball, and introduced the round ball, like in soccer. And then they developed like a hybrid-type goal, which has like a soccer-style net, but H-style posters in rugby, and developed their own rules. And the Gaelic Athletic Association itself was the governing body of both Gaelic football and hurling, developed into a much broader cultural association than simply a sporting body. And so it's very closely associated with Irish nationalism, very closely associated with other Irish cultural traditions as well. And so the GAA and football in Ireland became very much part of Irish nationalist cultural traditions and became, if you like, a signifier of the desire of the Irish people for independence in the 19th century, but also, I mean, still is today. It's you know, the GAA sees itself as a very, very important representative of the journey of the Irish nation from being part of the British Empire to independence that we have today. So Gaelic football is a type of football that was developed for very explicit political purposes in order to give expression to an Irish culture that they felt, that Irish nationalists felt, was not represented in the football games that were being played in Britain in the 19th century.
At the time of recording, it is the Women's World Cup, and it may come as a surprise to many that women were heavily involved in the early history of football.
Yeah, well, I think one of the very interesting things, but also in a sense a concerning thing, is that when football starts to be developed in the English private schools in the middle of the 19th century, it's very much part of what is seen as training young men to be men, to become men. It's about instilling a masculine spirit in them. And that's, in a sense, that's what muscular Christianity, the idea that Christianity was about, you know, leadership and physicality, was very much about. And so it's quite clear that football and other sports were introduced into the public schools, both, if you like, to harden young men, to prepare them for some of them, for a life in the military, but also to make sure they weren't becoming effeminate or becoming gay, which was a big concern in British public schools in the middle of the 19th century. And so women were not seen as part of the football world. And in fact, for many people, the fact that women weren't part of the football world was one of the great things about all the different types of football, because it allowed men to socialise outside of the influence of women. So in many ways, women were explicitly excluded from football for a long time. You get, in the 1880s, you find that there are some games of football that are played on a public stage. I mean, I think women, you know, certainly girls and young women probably always played football as long as young men did, because they would have played with their brothers and their fathers possibly at home. There's certainly evidence that some girls played at schools where their fathers were teachers and things like that. And if you go back in history, in the older types of local football, folk football, then there's a number of instances where women played either in games with men or played separate games. But by the time you get to the mid-19th century and the invention of modern football, they're not being included, and that's a deliberate policy. It's seen very much as a kind of, you know, masculine world that women aren't part of. And you do get games being played on as a type of music hall style entertainment in the 1880s. You know, there's famous examples in 1881 where so-called England versus Scotland matches are staged. And in fact, you know, a number of them are stopped by riots by people, you know, by men who don't like the idea of women to play football. But these are really commercial ventures that aren't really designed to promote women's football. It's just, you know, a form of titillation in a lot of ways. You do get the British Ladies Football Club, which is quite famous, that played in the from 1895 onwards. And that's kind of a bit of a hybrid, because it's both a commercial enterprise that they go out and play dozens and dozens of matches, while still promoting the idea that football is a game for women, certainly in the press. But they don't do anything to establish other teams. They just, you know, play exhibition matches against each other, a bit like the way the Harlem Globetrotters play basketball. And although there are, you know, these are obviously women who can play the game and think that they're just as much right to play the game as men have and can be, you know, just as good if they had the training, there's no sense that they are trying to set up a league for women or anything like that. And so women in the 19th century and early 20th century, until you get to the First World War, are really very much excluded from football, and really to play have to try really hard and be really committed to try to play the game, because of all the obstacles that are put in the way, both explicitly in terms of, you know, Football Association trying to stop games, but also culturally. You know, the dominant story that's coming out of the media at that time is that, you know, football is a game for men and certainly not a game for women. So it's not until we get to the First World War when that women's teams are set up in factories as a part of to develop kind of, you know, team spirit during factory work during wartime, and to raise money for wartime charities, that women's football really takes off in a way that, you know, if it hadn't had those obstacles in the 19th century, it may have done a much earlier date.
Now, I couldn't record a podcast with someone who has literally written the book on the history of football and not asked them the one football match from the few hundred years or so that they would love to go back and watch. And well, the answer isn't any of the recent classics, but it's something interesting nonetheless.
Ooh, that's a tough question. Well, from a fan's perspective, you know, because my family's sport is rugby league, it's kind of, I would have loved to have watched one of the first Great Britain versus Australia test matches before the First World War, with some great players that we'll never be able to see because there's no footage. But I think in terms of social significance, if you're going to pick out one match that's the most significant in the history of football, I would probably think that it's the Old Etonians versus Darwin FA Cup matches of off the top of my head, 1878. I think those matches play, as I talked about earlier on, when they're played between, you know, Eton is the most elite private school in Britain and arguably in the world, certainly in the world at that point. And here you have a bunch of men who, you know, working class blokes, made their living by manual labour, working in a factory. They were playing the absolute elite of British society. They drew with them twice and then lost the third match. And I think that what that signified was that football could become one of those rare spaces in British life where the two classes could meet on equal terms. And the working class players could actually defeat the upper class players. And I think that's significant in itself. But also, I think in terms of the popularity of the FA Cup and of football, that was a tremendous boost to the popularity of the game, because it demonstrated to people that football was more than just 22 men, as they were at that time, kicking the ball around a pitch. It had a much greater social and cultural significance, and the excitement that would have generated, and the hope, in a sense, as well, from the Darwin supporters, and also the hope that would have generated, kind of raised football far beyond just being an amusement or a recreation or even a sport. It put football, if you like, it made football a phenomenon of social and cultural importance, and probably for the first time. And I think that match is a match that, you know, we can trace back to where we are, where football is today. We can trace it back to that point.
On April 18th, 2021, 12 of the biggest football clubs in Europe announced plans to form a breakaway competition known as the European Super League. The proposal was met with widespread criticism from fans, football governing bodies, and even political figures. Critics argued that the move was driven by greed and would damage the competitive nature of the sport, as the European Super League was designed to be a closed league with no promotion or relegation. The backlash was swift and intense. Fans continued protesting, players and coaches spoke out against it, and UEFA and FIFA threatened to ban the participating clubs and their players from other competitions. Within 48 hours of the announcement, several clubs began to withdraw from the European Super League due to the backlash. By 11:30 p.m. on 23rd of April 2021, all six English clubs had pulled out of the project, followed by a number of the other teams. The Super League effectively collapsed just a few days after it was announced. The fallout from the controversy continued for some time, with many calling for reforms in football governance and club ownership models. Now, taking all of that into account, I had to ask Tony, who literally wrote the book on the history of football, what he thought about the European Super League.
Well, that's a great question, because I think this is a question that's more complicated than what it appears, because I'll say from the outset that, you know, I've got no brief for the European Super League or, you know, any elite competition, because I think the great thing about football of whatever type, wherever it's played, is that essentially it's about representatives of a community playing other representatives of other communities, and I think that's a great way to, you know, to generate a feeling of community spirit and solidarity. And I think that's, in a sense, if you like, from a social perspective, that's the most important thing about football. And anything that undermines that, I think, is bad. So, you know, whatever code of football it is, whoever's playing. So having said that, I think if you look back in history, then what's going on today in football with the attempts to create a European Super League, the way in which the elite clubs are coming together, they're trying to create an organisation that's based, you know, purely on commercial viability and purely on its ability to generate more money for those elite clubs. That's actually exactly why the Football League was formed in 1888. The impetus for the Football League was two reasons. One of the problems that the elite clubs had with the FA Cup was that, because it's a draw, You know, there's the teams are drawn out of a hat. It's a random selection. You could have, for example, Aston Villa play Blackburn Rovers, two of the leading teams of the time, play each other in the first round. One of them's knocked out, and then the other team has no, you know, is deprived of its most important source of revenue for the rest of the season. And so they wanted a way whereby the top teams could have guaranteed revenue every week of the season. And they decided, the Football League authorities decided that the way the clubs would be selected was on the basis of which were the most commercially viable. And so teams were selected on the basis of things like how close they were to the railway station, because that meant it was easier to get to and from a ground, both for the players and for the spectators. They were selected on the basis of where their local, you know, where their nearest local rivals were. And also, as the Football League grew, it was basically where they wanted to expand, what was most commercially viable, yeah, what were the best places to expand commercially. So, the tendencies that have led to the formation of the European Super League have been in football ever since professionalism and the Football League was formed. It's not that what's going on today is a new phenomenon. I think once football became a professional and commercial sport, these things were always going to happen. But having said that, I think the danger is today that there is the amount of money that's in the game will actually divorce these clubs from their communities, and I think there's a real danger that that's going to happen now. And the appeal of football, that it's about one locality against another, will disappear, and effectively it will simply become another form of Hollywood entertainment.
And that's the end of another intriguing podcast episode. I hope you enjoyed listening to it as much as I enjoyed creating this podcast. If you're passionate about the work I'm doing and want to support it, consider becoming a paid YouTube member to unlock some cool features or join our Patreon community. You can find the link in the description below. Thanks again for tuning in, and I'll hopefully see you in the next video. Bye!